Okay, welcome back to the lecture, Cryptographic Communication Protocols. Last week, we looked at practical messaging systems, somewhat the final or the most important practical aspect or part of this lecture. We looked at the double ratchet protocol on a rather high level. Before that, we collected enough information to understand how does key update work, which components do we have, which components could we have to implement or build such a protocol. And the double ratchet protocol is surprisingly simple. It consists of two components, the asymmetric ratchet and the symmetric ratchet. The asymmetric ratchet is just a Diffie-Hellman key exchange that continuously works between Alice and Bob. So they continuously share new Diffie-Hellman shares and compute the resulting Diffie-Hellman key exchanges. From those Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, Alice and Bob derive symmetric keys, and these key derivations work in round trips. So basically, we have a round trip based Diffie-Hellman key exchange. And in order to be sure that Alice and Bob can perform these Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, even if messages are lost in transmission or messages are reordered, then this round trip makes sure that things still work, because basically every message that is sent from Alice in her round trip will contain the same information as the first message in that round trip. So the ciphertexts somewhat have redundancy, and so the round trips continue until the communication is over. And so the asymmetric ratchet makes sure we have post-compromise security. We establish fresh secrets from random coins that the attacker cannot foresee in the past. And it also has a somewhat weak notion of forward security, because, of course, we remove old exponents once we create new exponents in this double in this asymmetric Diffie-Hellman-based ratchet. And so also, previous things cannot be computed after they have been used, after new round trips started. And then the symmetric ratchet is just basically from the Diffie-Hellman key exchanges deriving symmetric keys and storing them in case things were received out of order, but removing things immediately after they have been used. So all the chain keys, all the root keys, all these symmetric keys in this big grid of different keys that depend on each other. First of all, root keys from the Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, then the chain keys from the root keys, and then the message keys from the chain keys. All of these things are removed immediately after they have been used. So this is a super fine-grained notion of forward security. Basically, everything that has been received cannot be recomputed afterwards. Okay, this is the double ratchet. And the question was, okay, how can we achieve security in group messaging? And the oldest idea of how to achieve this is just using the pairwise two-party double ratchet channels or any other two-party channels. And then we just have one pair or one pairwise channel to each group member. And when we send a message, we basically send n-1 ciphertexts to one to each group member. This is inefficient for large groups. And so two big alternatives turned out to be practically relevant. The first one is, we just have a symmetric ratchet, and each sender has their own symmetric ratchet. This is the sender key approach. The sender key approach means in a group, n users each have a sender key, and the sender key is a chain key. And we derive, or the sender, when sending, derives from the chain key a new chain key for the next message and a message key. The message key is used for encryption, and the chain key is used to derive the message key for the next message once the sender wants to send the next message. And now each receiver has the chain keys or the chains and a storage for out-of-order delivery for all of the senders in the group. So each receiver basically has one chain key for each group member for receiving, plus their own sender key when they want to send. But as the receiver role, they have n-1 chain keys for receiving. And the idea is, when I send something, I just have a constant size ciphertext that I send to everyone, and everyone can receive that thing. Everyone has the key. Now, how do we build that? How do we initiate a conversation via sender keys? sender keys. So basically, let's write that quickly down. We have the send. We have first of all the pairwise approach. And we just have these pairwise channels. Then the sender key approach is, if I want to send something, I send one ciphertext, and that ciphertext is sent to everyone. And everyone has the corresponding key to decrypt things, and so communication overhead is very, very small. The problem is, how do we distribute the keys? For distribution of keys, we just use the pairwise channels. So at least at the initialization of a conversation, but also once we want to update the key for post-compromise security, we would need to use the pairwise channels. This is again inefficient, but it is less inefficient than always using the pairwise channels. The sender key approach directly and inherently achieves forward security for the same reason that the pairwise channels achieve forward security. We just have a chain key. Everything that has been used will be removed immediately from the device, and we are happy. And then the final approach is the one that is exemplified by the tree Diffie-Hellman protocol, and we will look at the tree CAM protocol today. And the tree CAM protocol is basically the core cryptographic component that has been established in the message layer security standard that has been standardized last year. And there, each user is basically a leaf in a tree. And the group key is the key that is at the root of that tree. And I don't go deeper into the details here because, as I said, the first thing that we look at today is the TreeCAM protocol. We briefly talked about the reasons why CAMs are important today in the exercise. The reason is, first of all, CAMs are more generic. So Diffie-Hellman is just one instantiation of non-interactive key exchange. There are very few ideas of how to build non-interactive key exchange in the literature for today, and especially in practical terms. But there are many CAM instantiations. In particular, there are multiple approaches or proposals for how to build a CAM that is post-quantum secure. Both Diffie-Hellman key exchange and also the Al-Gamal CAM are not post-quantum secure. So if we have quantum computers, tree Diffie-Hellman, and also the standard double-ratchet protocol is not secure anymore. And so there was a lot of research on how to extend the double-ratchet protocol with CAMs. We talked about this in the exercise today. And we will look at how to replace the Diffie-Hellman operations in the tree-based Diffie-Hellman today in order to build TreeCAM. The second problem that one is faced with when trying to build group messaging is concurrency. So what happens if multiple users in a group send something simultaneously? We will see that in the pairwise channels, this is not a problem. People just send something in their pairwise channels simultaneously. The only problem is then how to display that in the app. So when was what and all these things, but this is just UX design. This is nothing that cryptographers need to think about too much. The next step or the next idea is sender keys. Again, the sender key approach, each sender is independent of the other sender. So each sender chain, keychain, is independent of the other keychains, and so senders can just send things and receivers can just receive things. Again, the only problem that occurs there is in the UX design. And of course, on a higher level, group management is a problem if people want to update the group simultaneously, but this is not what we talk about today. Concurrency and the problem that we will look at today is that, let's say that two users simultaneously want to update their keys in this tree structure. And we will see this is not trivial. It is not straightforward how to update keys in this tree structure simultaneously, concurrently. And the final task that I would like to look at, or the final part, the final idea that I would like to look at with you today is anonymous messaging or privacy-preserving messaging. And we will actually see that privacy-preserving messaging is interesting. Signal implements a sender anonymous protocol in which the server basically does not learn who sent a message. The server learns who will receive a message because that is necessary for efficient delivery. Not maybe necessary, but it makes efficient delivery much easier if the server knows where to put a ciphertext to. But the sender information is not relevant to the server, and so we will look at sender privacy or sender anonymity at the end of today's lecture. Okay, but the first thing that we look at today is TreeChem. Any questions so far? Nothing. Okay. So we had multiple users: Alice, Bob, Charlie, Dave, Eve, and others. And the first thing that Alice, Bob, Charlie, Dave, and Eve do when starting a group conversation, and we would like to use chems for that, is that they generate key material. And the key material that Alice and Bob generate is secret key of Bob, of Alice, public key of Alice, secret key of Bob, public key of Bob, secret key of Charlie, public key of Charlie, secret key of Dave, public key of Dave, secret key of Eve, and public key of Eve, and so on. Now, the idea that we had in this tree structure last week was that Charlie and Dave and Alice and Bob and Eve and Frank want to establish shared secrets. So Alice and Bob want to compute a key KAB. Charlie and Dave want to compute KCD, and so on. So how could Alice and Bob do that with a chem? And let's say Alice is the one who starts, but Dave is the one who starts there. So what could they do? How could they compute the key?
Take the secret key and the public key of the other party.
But we would like to build it with chems instead of the human key exchange. Well, that's the purpose of TreeChem. Why do you think so?
I think that both should contribute to the secret pushing.
Why is that important?
Otherwise, like, if only Alice contributes, it's kind of like Alice is, Alice controls the secret.
Um, There is a long history of group key agreement, 30, 40 years, and contributiveness was one of the properties that has been discussed for a very long time. And it is unclear how far it is necessary or how far it is helpful. At the end, what we typically do, or what we typically require, is just we require that the key of the group is secure against certain threats. And it is unclear what the threat is that would occur if only one of the two parties contributes randomness to the key. A problem could be, and that is definitely a problem, let's say Alice is member of the group and Bob is member of the group. Now, Alice encapsulates to Bob, and at some point she leaves the group, and from that moment on, she's considered malicious. But she could also be considered malicious from the very first time that she was member of the group. So all the random coins that she ever sampled were maybe malicious, maybe constant, maybe, I don't know, using a bad distribution for the chem that is used. So in principle, all the keys that are ever contributed or computed by or influenced by Alice should be treated as insecure from the moment she is not a member of the group anymore. So after that, all the keys should become independent of what Alice is doing. But it turns out that even if this is the case, then it is not relevant that while she is a member of the group, anybody else contributes equally to the keys that they compute. Because either while she's a member of the group, she's evil, and then we don't have guarantees because the keys are known to the attacker, or she was honest while she was a member of the group, and then also the keys are honest because then she used honest key material. The only guarantees that we would like to have is that everything that happened before she was a member and after she was a member, if she is always malicious, these keys before and after her membership still should be secure. And for this, it is not relevant what happens while she is a member.
What if Alice's randomness is revealed, but Bob's isn't?
Mm-hmm.
Like then an attacker could compute the key that, only Alice encapsulated.
Yeah, that is a relevant problem. And one could try to achieve strongest security with respect to all the small randomness or secret state exposures that could ever happen. And in order to achieve slightly stronger security, both could contribute to that, to the current key. That is indeed, could be a good reason to do that. But the alternative to that would be that either Alice will update her key in a couple of steps, and then she hopefully uses good randomness, or Bob updates his path from the leaf to the root, and then anyway, if we assume that Bob's randomness is good, then everything is good after that again. Yeah.
Just a question.
Sure.
Does the encapsulating Bob's public key output the same ciphertext that Alice sent to Bob?
So, Alice uses the public key of Bob to encapsulate a key, send the ciphertext to Bob. And so, not sure what the question was, but the answer is, yes, this ciphertext is sent from Alice to Bob using the public key of Bob. Okay. All right. Now, the problem is Alice and Bob and Charlie and Dave now need a joint public key. Question is where to get that from. Quick reminder of how it looked just last week. Does anybody remember how the public key was generated last week? We just basically use the key that is encapsulated from Alice to Bob as the random coins or the seed for generating the next public key. And we could imagine that we could use the same random coins also to get the secret key of Alice and Bob. And the same is done between Charlie and Dave. So Dave encapsulates to Charlie's public key. Both of them know then the key KCD. And then using the key KCD, they can generate, they can generate their joint public key. Again, both of these groups want to communicate. In this case, Alice and Bob communicate to Bob and Charlie. They send a ciphertext CAD from them to them. This ciphertext is output together with the key by encapsulating to the public key of Charlie and Dave. And finally, so we have more or less the same structure on the left side of this tree. And now let's say, oh wait, I forgot something. Of course, Alice, Bob, Charlie, and Dave generate a joint public key. For this, they use KAD. And then we assume that the ciphertext CAH is sent from the right side of the tree to the left side of the tree. And this ciphertext is just computed by encapsulating KAH, CAH to the public key of Alice to Dave. And then the public key of the entire group is generated deterministically from KAH. Okay. This is the high-level idea. Pretty simple, very close to what the tree Diffie-Hellman is doing. Now, just to repeat what the tree Diffie-Hellman is doing, we quickly look at the case that Charlie is corrupted. And since Charlie thinks she is corrupted, we treat all the secrets that are on her path as corrupted too. Now, there are two things or two perspectives on what Charlie would do. The first perspective is basically just describing what I just did and then thinking about one small problem that we ignored so far. So first of all, what Charlie would do is she would generate a fresh key pair. She would share the public key with Dave, and then she would encapsulate a key, KCD, CCD, to Dave. Then she would use the key to generate a public key for the two of them, for Charlie and Dave, by using the key KCD. She would do the same with Alice and Bob. So she would compute a key KAD, CAD, by encapsulating to the public key of Alice and Bob. And she would compute a public key for all of them by deterministically generating the public key with KAD. And the fourth step is just doing the same again for the entire group. So computing KAH, CAH, by encapsulating to the public key of the right side of the tree, which is public key EH, and then generating a public key for the entire group deterministically with the key that she just encapsulated. And we're happy, in principle. Did anybody see a problem of that description? Did anybody see? Yeah?
I just have a question.
Sure.
So, yeah, as Bob, they get their shared secret.
Mm-hmm.
And then, who does this operation to encapsulate to Charlie and Dave?
So let's say we are in the Charlie update operation, then Charlie is doing everything. So Charlie is doing the computation. So what happens here in fact is that, so when Charlie is doing her update, she will send ciphertext CD to Dave. Ciphertext AD to Alice and Bob, and ciphertext AH to the right side of the tree.
Yeah. And I'm not sure how does Dave know the sequence?
That is exactly the question that I would like someone to ask me. Perfect, thank you. So, what we see here is that Dave, when doing these operations here, can compute KCD and can compute PKCD. So, everything here is fine, right? First step is fine. Now, the second step. Ciphertext AD is sent to the left quarter of this tree. So, Alice and Bob can take CAD to compute the new, or to decapsulate the ciphertext that was sent here, compute the new KAD, and compute the new public key. So those two, they are fine. But how would Dave do that? That is, I think, the question, right?
Yes.
Exactly. So what the big problem here, just to give everybody the opportunity to understand the question, is this ciphertext here, is computed with the public key of Alice and Bob. And so Alice and Bob can decapsulate it because they know the secret key, but nobody else can. So this randomness here, this is only known to Charlie. So Charlie is doing this here. And the question becomes even more problematic if we look at the final step here. So this final step here, the ciphertext AH, this one here, this is produced and sent to the right side of the tree. It is produced by Charlie. So Charlie encapsulates to the public key of the right side of the tree here. The right side of the tree knows the secret key. So everybody knows the secret key EAH. And so everybody on the right side can compute KAH. But the question is, how will Dave, Alice, and Bob compute KAH? They don't know the secret key EH. But they also don't know the randomness that is used here for encapsulation. Okay, everybody sees the problem? Does everybody see the problem? Okay, anybody see a solution?
Yeah, so, I mean, let's start, I guess, with Charlie and Dave. Like, they already have a shared secret, you could just use that as randomness, like you can hash it or something, and use it as randomness, or instantly.
So in each step, we just add another operation, and that operation is that we compute two seeds. Seed for the public key and a seed for encapsulation. And those seeds are generated with a key derivation function from KCD. Now, instead of using KCD as the input to the generation algorithm, we use seed PK, and instead of using a randomized encapsulation, we use a deterministic encapsulation using the seed encapsulation. We do the same thing here, so we compute a seed PK and a seed encapsulation, and this is derived from KAD. And instead of generating the key again from that key directly, we use the seed that we previously computed as PK, and we de-randomize the encapsulation using the seed for encapsulation. We also do that finally here to compute the seed for public key, and we compute a key for the group, and that again, computed from the key derivation function using as input KAH. And the public key is again computed with the seed. And then we have a specific key for the entire group. Okay, now there is a bracket missing. So what happens now is that Charlie, for herself, computes an own key pair. That should be randomized, definitely, because that is the thing that was corrupted on her leaf. So here, this thing that was corrupted, so she wants to generate a fresh thing, this should be randomized. And then also the process here for updating her path, that should initially also be somewhat randomized. It doesn't really matter if this randomness is just generated here implicitly or input here explicitly and sampled somewhere else. Now, because this computation here is just shared with the secret key of Dave, so Charlie knows this, the public key, she knows her own random coins, and so she knows KCD, and Dave knows the secret key. Using the ciphertext CCD, Dave can compute KCD. Then both of them know the key that is computed here. They can use it and input it to a key derivation function from which they produce two seeds. One seed to compute the joint public key, and the second seed for the next step in the tree to de-randomize the encapsulation. So now both users, Charlie and Dave, can compute the encapsulation to the public key AB with the same randomness. So we are in this step here. This ciphertext here, CAD, is sent to the left quarter of the tree. And the problem that we previously had was that if Charlie is doing this encapsulation on her own, then the randomness is not known to Dave. So what we do here is we derive the randomness from the shared secret that we compute here. And now this ciphertext is deterministically computed, but the deterministic source of this computation comes from the initial encapsulation here. So KCD is input here, KCD is the seed for the encapsulation here, and so the encapsulation is known to compute KAD and CAD. So Dave knows everything that Alice and Bob also know in order to, sufficiently in order to compute the same information that is necessary to compute the joint node of Alice to Dave that is computed here. Now everyone, Alice to Dave, all of them know the key KAD, and so all of them, all four of them, can compute the seeds for the public key generation and for the encapsulation. And now with that information, all of them, so the entire left half of the tree, can compute the encapsulation, all of them know that seed, all of them know the public key EH, and so all of them can compute KAH and then derive the key information that is necessary to compute the public key for the entire group and the symmetric key that can be used for symmetric encryption. And so what we see here is that both with TreeCam and with TreeFV-Hellman, we have to send one packet of information to each node on the copath. So I have to send one ciphertext to Dave, if I'm Charlie, and I have to send one ciphertext to Alice and Bob. Both of them will know what to do with it, and Dave can compute that packet and can compute all the secret information about that packet because it is derived from the key that that Charlie shares with Dave. And now again, everything that is shared between Charlie, Alice, Dave, and Bob, all of the four, all of them know the seed that is necessary to compute the packet and the secret information that is sent to the right half of the tree. Okay, so the idea is first of all, encapsulate once to each node on the copath, and all secrets higher in the tree are deterministically derived from that. Okay, on a very high level, this is everything that we would like to know about how TreeCam works. The problem that I talked about at the very beginning that we would like to shed a light on is concurrency. So let's consider that Bob and Charlie want to update. So we have Alice, Bob, Charlie, Dave, Eve, and so on. So both Bob and Charlie think that their secrets are corrupted, and so everything on these paths here are, everything is corrupted. So with the construction that we just described, if Charlie and Bob do their updates, then first of all, both of them generate key material for themselves. So now Bob and Charlie just have a new, or generate secret keys, public keys for themselves, share the public keys with their neighbors in the tree, and they are happy. The next thing that both of them do is they send a ciphertext to their neighbors. So Alice, Bob sends a ciphertext to Alice, Charlie sends a ciphertext to Dave, and so both of them are again happy. The secret that is computed here is only known to Alice and Bob, and the other one is only known to Charlie and Dave, and they are happy. And now the next thing that both of them would like to compute is a secret that belongs here. What is the problem when both of them want to do that? And I don't want to know it algorithmically, so what is the problem that both of them overwrite the same information? What is the problem if both of them do that with respect to security? So both of them want to compute information in that tree here. Let's look at that situation in that tree again. So both Alice and Bob want to update this information. What is the problem? They want to do that simultaneously. And although I was writing this here step by step, so this the first step on both sides and this is the second step, of course, if I mean simultaneously, Bob will compute things and then send a packet of all information that is necessary for updating the entire path, and simultaneously Charlie is doing that. So they don't know of each other that both of them are doing updates, and they also don't know of any information that the other one is sending right now. So basically, both of them are just doing that independent of each other with respect to the information that they saw before they were starting to update their part of the tree. So what is the problem? What is the problem? Well, why is there a problem? I mean, both of them could update things and then we just have something in parallel. Maybe we just have ciphertext sent from Alice to Bob, initiated by Bob, and a ciphertext sent from Charlie to Dave, initiated by Charlie. These ciphertexts cross the wire, and then we just maybe don't have a tree for a moment, maybe just we have two nodes on that level of the hierarchy. But what can we do with these two nodes? How far is this interesting, relevant, problematic for us? Is there a problem? Let's look at the information that Bob has when trying to share something with Charlie and Dave, and the information that Charlie has when trying to share a new secret with Alice and Bob. So the update here, Bob's update starts with generating an on-key pair. Charlie is doing the same. They're happy. Then both of them send a ciphertext to the public key of Dave, respectively Alice, and each of them compute ciphertext to the partner, compute a joint public key, and they're happy. Everything is fine. Now the next step, here is an encapsulation on both sides. So Charlie will encapsulate to the public key of Alice and Bob, but the public key of Alice and Bob before Bob started the update. And Bob will encapsulate to the public key of Charlie and Dave, but the public key that existed before Charlie started the update. So what is the problem with that? What is the problem with that? What was the problem with the public key of CD and the public key of AB before the updates? And now they are still corrupted. We didn't win anything. So B encapsulates to a public key that was corrupted due to the corruption of C, and C encapsulates to a public key that was corrupted and considered corrupted due to the corruption of B. The concurrent update, if it is done the way we would do it, as if there was no concurrency, is ineffective. We didn't win anything. If two users at the same time were corrupted, and if two users at the same time try to recover from that corruption, then this recovery is ineffective. There is no new information that is not known to the attacker, because the attacker knows secret from the one side and the secret from the other side. If both of them want to encrypt something to the corrupted secrets, we don't win. Interestingly, we can prove that this is a problem, unless we had a solution to the following impractical building block. So, impractical solution But this would be an impact, or it would be a solution for the entire group messaging thing in the first place. We would have multi-party non-interactive key exchange. So we basically can compute a key AH from a function evaluate that takes as input the public keys of Alice to the public key of H together with the secret key of Charlie, for example. And this is the same as eval from public key of Alice to public key of H with the secret key of Alice, and so on. But we don't have multi-party non-interactive key exchange. There are no practical constructions existing. And as long as we don't have that, we will need to think about possible solutions. So what are possible solutions? Let's call this just possible solution for now. So we are still in the state or in the situation that things were corrupted. So we have Alice, Bob, Charlie, Dave, Eve, and so on. And in the first run, this here is corrupted. So what Alice and Bob could do is, Bob and Charlie only update their individual secrets. So this would be what they would do in the first step. In the second step, every sender in the next round proposes new path updates for Bob and Charlie. So in the second round, we basically copy this, and multiple users propose updates for the rest of the tree. The seeds for path updates encrypted to the public key, to the new public key of Bob and Charlie. And just an algorithm chooses one of the proposals. Okay, so this will be a solution. So instead of letting Bob and Charlie update their own path, they will just update their own local public keys, and then somebody else will update the path, the rest of the path. properties of that are, first of all, relatively weak communication, low communication costs. Bigger problem is that others know the secrets on Bob's and Charlie's paths. And this is an invariant that we would like to avoid. So we look back at the big tree here. With all the operations that we did so far, everybody would just update the secrets on their own path. We talked about adding and removing users recently, in the last week. The basic idea that I proposed was that if a new user is added, we will just sponsor them a node under our own node. So if Charlie wants to add a new user, she would move one step lower or one level lower in the tree and add the new user in the sibling node. The problem there is, or there is no problem about updating her own path. A problem occurs if we want to remove another user. So let's say Charlie wants to remove Bob. Then what I proposed last week would be that Charlie would override the nodes on Bob's path. This is unproblematic for these two nodes, but it is problematic for this and that node. Because now she knows a node on Alice's path. What happens if Charlie is removed is that we need to remove all the secrets that Charlie knew when she was removed from the group. And this includes her own path, but it also includes that path here, or that node and that node, because she overrode those paths when she removed Bob. And this is a cascade that would continue if Charlie is actively removing users or multiple times removing users. And for that reason, the MLS protocol and almost all protocols that are based on such a tree messaging hierarchy propose that if someone is removed, you basically remove that user here and we blank all the nodes here, and this user is then just directly connected to the next non-blanked node. So this node here would then still be unblanked because this is a node that everybody in the group knows. But then Alice would basically be connected to that node in the worst case. In a better case, if Charlie is the one who is removing someone, Alice would be connected to that node here. But also if there are multiple users, they would be connected, directly to that node. But this would degrade the perfect binary tree in something that is worse in terms of how much information needs to be shared with other users when Alice wants to update her node or her path to the root. Or if somebody else, like Dave, would like to update, then the copath is suddenly not only this node here, but there are multiple users who belong to that node, and so we have a bigger problem if you want to simplify things. Now, a similar thing occurs if parts of updating concurrently would be that if Bob and Charlie update things and Eve is the one who is talking in the round after Bob and Charlie just updated their local secret keys and public keys, then Eve would propose a path from Bob to the root and from Charlie to the root, and then Eve would know all the nodes or all the secrets on the nodes of Bob and Charlie. And that would be, again, a similar problem when Eve was removed. So if Eve was then removed, then not only Eve's path would need to be updated, but also Bob's and Charlie's path would need to be updated. Okay, interestingly, for the low communication costs, there is a proof almost optimal, that it is almost optimal. I don't go into the details here. This is a paper from TCC 21 by Beanstalk et al. And there are further ideas. And solutions. A team from Vienna proposed two papers, or published two papers. The first one is from Eurocrypt 22 with the title COA. Final A is also capitalized. And the idea is that instead of doing the update in one step or in two steps, where Bob and Charlie just do their own secrets and then everybody else will update their paths, we split the update into long log n rounds, where n is the number of group members. So split update into log n steps, or log n rounds, more steps. And this distributes the overhead of the communication into these steps. But of course, if we need log n rounds for a large group, let's say we have 1,000 users, this costs us 10 rounds, and if we want to have round synchronization, this is also, again, a little bit expensive. So instead of higher communication overhead, we have slower recovery. But this paper or this solution solves the problem. Of learning secrets on other users' paths. The second paper, also by Alvin et al., is, as far as I know, not published yet, but it is a preprint, also from 2022, called DKEF. And instead of splitting things in multiple rounds, we merge Diffie-Hellman operations. So the Diffie-Hellman key exchange has the property that Diffie-Hellman shares can be multiplied, and so the exponents are added, and this very specific homomorphism of operations can be used and exploited here to merge multiple proposals of new paths. And as one can see is that if one repeats these operations in which things on the path are merged, eventually the entire or all of the updated paths will be secure, even though at the very beginning things that were not merged did not refer to things that were secure. So at the beginning we had the problem that when Bob updates something knowing something about Charlie from the round before that, then the update of Bob was basically ineffective. But if Bob and Charlie do their updates independent of each other, and at that point here they are merged, and then they do that thing again and merge things at the very top root again, then finally things become secure. But the problem of that is that, again, we need, or that we fall back from the chem idea to something that is based on Diffie-Hellman. And while these updates here in this work here, these updates were dependent on the number of group members, we here need to repeat this process only t times, where t is the number of or the degree of concurrency. Okay, this was everything that I wanted to tell you about concurrency. There is a literature that is broader and broader that tried to propose things to make concurrency not an issue. Concurrency is, of course, an issue in a group setting in which multiple users can send simultaneously. So in groups, concurrency is a much bigger problem, and those are initial proposals, those are initial ideas. None of these solutions, none of these ideas has been implemented in the MLS standard. The problem was that all of these solutions were either a little bit too late or did use building blocks that are not standard enough to implement them in a standard. Because if you want to implement a standard, you typically want to just use a normal crypto library. And some of these ideas used building blocks that are not directly useful or implemented in crypto libraries. So you could not tell implementers all over the world, okay, this is what we do here. You can just use your typical crypto library and implement things. And for those reasons, the concurrency solution in the MLS standard is basically, if two users want to update their path simultaneously, then only one user can actually do so. So only one update will be taken, and the path of the other user will be removed entirely. And the only thing that keeps in the path of the other user is their leaf key pair. And so they are basically directly attached then to the root. And if they want to update, or if they want to be part of the group entirely again, either their direct neighbor on the leaf level, so on the lowest level, will update things, or they will do an update. But that means that basically updates in MLS are necessarily sequentially. So no efficient concurrency is permitted in the MLS standard. The last interesting topic that I wanted to talk about is anonymous messaging or privacy preserving. And for this, I would like to talk about the two practically most important messaging protocols that we've seen in the lecture, and this is the double ratchet algorithm and the sender key approach. So first of all, the double ratchet, we have Alice and Bob, and we can imagine there is another user, Charlie, somewhere. And the double ratchet was basically Alice sends again, maybe Bob replies, maybe simultaneously, Alice sends again, maybe Bob sends once more, but the ciphertext is blocked, and then finally, Alice sends once more, and Alice sends once more. Okay. We have a little bit of training now in how to understand when the updates really happen, so when round trips are filled, so I don't need to do that training with you again. So let's consider those are the keys that mark round trips in the communication. And we also have a conversation between Charlie and Dave. So basically, Charlie sends, Bob and Charlie. Bob sends something to Charlie. Charlie responds. Maybe Bob sends again a couple of times. Then Bob and Charlie send simultaneously. And Bob sends at the very end again. Again, we have round trips. And we are happy. Now, whenever there is a new round trip, Alice and Bob perform Diffie-Hellman operations. And between these operations, they just use their symmetric ratchet. And this continues basically forever. Okay. Now what we would like to do is we would like to have sender anonymity. Sender anonymity means that a ciphertext does not reveal any information about anything besides the receiver. So there is a ciphertext, and that ciphertext says, I look like a random ciphertext, except that I tell you who the receiver is. And that means that whenever Bob receives a ciphertext, even Bob should not learn where that ciphertext is coming from, but Bob should still be able to process that ciphertext. And in the double ratchet setting, it is important to know how to process things. The idea that is implemented in Signal to achieve sender anonymity is using the so-called sealed sender mechanism. And sealed sender works as follows. We have public key encryption from sender to receiver of full double ratchet / sender key packet plus receiver identity. So basically, this is public key encrypt to public key of receiver of ciphertext double ratchet / sender key concatenated with the ID of the receiver. Okay, so this is what Signal uses today. They just encrypt any ciphertext that Alice sends to Bob with Bob's public key, and they attach the identity of Bob, and so the server knows, aha, okay, the ciphertext goes to Bob, here it is. And the receiver, so Bob, knows they will just use their secret key to get the double ratchet or a sender key ciphertext. Okay, decryption is efficient, things are sender anonymous, and we are happy. Big problem. Receiver corruption leads to no sender anonymity. So all the properties that we have in messaging with forward security and post-compromise security are immediately gone for the anonymity level once the receiver is corrupted, because this is just plain public key encryption. The other part that I quickly want to mention is that, let's say we have Alice, Bob, Charlie and Dave. And this is the timeline between them. And whenever Alice sends something, her ciphertext is just shared on the server side with all of the receivers, but it is just one ciphertext. This was what we know, or what we knew. And when she sends something again, she will derive a new message key from the chain key, from her sender chain, and everything is fine. The problem is, if we use this public key encryption approach, we will need to encrypt each ciphertext to each receiver. And so the constant-sized ciphertext becomes a linear-sized ciphertext again. All the performance gains that we achieve, especially the communication performance gains that we achieve due to the sender key mechanism, are gone once we want to achieve sender anonymity. So we have a linear overhead. Okay, so we basically memorize sealed sender both has no security against corruption and is a pretty bad solution if sender key mechanism is the thing that we use for group messaging. So what do we want to do? What is the solution? The solution is as follows. So what I said so far is we want to be able, as a receiver, to decrypt things immediately, but nobody, including the receiver, learns from the ciphertext where a ciphertext is coming from. And we want to have security even under corruption. So there is a large pool of keys. And let's write down this or mark this as a database. There is a database of keys that Bob uses for being able to receive things from Alice or from Charlie. And this database is filled with all of these keys equally. Because the problem is, whenever Bob receives a ciphertext, Bob does not know where it is coming from. But importantly, whenever things were received, these keys that were used to de-anonymize the ciphertext need to be removed. And also, we need to produce fresh keys whenever communication continues. And communication with Alice and Charlie produces new key material for de-anonymizing ciphertexts. Okay, so the solution looks as follows. We know that the Diffie-Hellman key exchanges in the round trips are computed reliably. So Alice here knows that this Diffie-Hellman key exchange on Bob's side definitely happened. This is somewhat the guarantee. And simultaneously, Bob knows when receiving a response to, so this is Bob's Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and Bob knows when receiving a response to this Diffie-Hellman key exchange, Alice definitely did this computation as well. So this is basically an acknowledgement that that happened. And so at that point here, Bob knows that this is a response to what Alice saw previously. We will see why this is important. So what we do here, or what Alice, what Bob does, is Bob computes a chain key, a key and a tag, and continues doing so and all of them are stored here. Now This is the same Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Well, basically, so this Diffie-Hellman key exchange consists of two Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, but the second one of those is the first one of this one. And from that first one, Alice will do the same. She will compute a chain key, a key, and a tag. And now she will compute this ciphertext with K1, and she will attach T1 to the ciphertext. And now, when Bob receives this ciphertext, he will find K1 T1 in the database, and then de-anonymize using K1. Alice, when she sends again, will compute the second key and the second tag. She will encrypt or anonymize that second ciphertext with K2, and she will attach T2 to the ciphertext from the outside. And also for her last key in for her last double ratchet ciphertext, she will compute a third key and a third tag and encrypt that double ratchet ciphertext with key 3 and attach T3 to it. Now T3 is a plain text. Bob will see it. Bob will try to find a key that matches that tag, and then we'll use it to, or use that key to de-anonymize with the found key. And he will do the same with the next keys and tags. And interestingly, the same works for the sender key mechanism. So Alice, when sending, starts with a chain key, computes together with it K1 and tag 1. She will encrypt the packet that she sends to everyone with K1, and she will attach T1 to it. And all the users on the receiver side, they will have a database in which they will try to find K1 T1 and then de-anonymize with K1. From that, Alice will compute K1 T1 and crypt. Oh no, this is K2 T2 encrypt with K2 and attach T2 to the ciphertext, and then all the receivers can find a matching entry in their database to de-anonymize the ciphertext and then do the decryption of the sender key mechanism. Okay, so the basic idea of that solution is, and I will just call it a better solution than sealed sender and anonymity wrapper. The basic idea of how to compute these keys is that We take the keys that we use for the encryption here, for the anonymization here, from half of the round trip before, because we know that the half of the round trip before happened. So Bob, when receiving a ciphertext here, knows that the ciphertext either belongs to one of the previous round trips, then these keys are definitely in the database, or belongs to the ciphertext that started the round trip here, and then also these keys have been computed and put into the database. So we know that in the future, in the next step, we can rely on previous round trips, and that's the reason why we can seed with a symmetric key from prior round trip. The receiver caches key tag pairs for upcoming round trip. So this is what we see here. The receiver knows I will get a response, and so for all the responses that I get, I will pre-compute things and put the keys and tags into my database such that when I receive them, I can find the tags and can decrypt things or de-anonymize things. The sender doesn't need to pre-compute things. The sender just uses the key tag chain continuously. And thereby encrypt the entire double ratchet respectively sender key packet, or let's call it ciphertext. And attaches the receiver ID. No. And once the receiver receives the ciphertext, they will just find, use, and then delete these key tag pairs, which gives us both forward anonymity because sender and receiver delete all keys after use, and it will give us post-compromise anonymity because the key tag chain is renewed with every round trip. Okay, so if we look at that again, this is our construction. When the receiver uses a key from the database with a tag, the key tag pair is removed from the database. The sender also continuously walks through that sender chain, removes keys and tags immediately after things were encrypted. And also, once here we start a new round trip, Bob would do the same again. So Bob would compute a bunch of keys and tags, store the key tag pairs in the database, and then once the key tags were used, first things are de-anonymized, and then these pairs are used from the database. We have forward anonymity, we have post-compromise anonymity, because this Diffie-Hellman key exchange here is not computable if things were corrupted here, and so everything that is derived from that, in particular also these anonymizing keys and tag pairs, are not computable, and so we have also post-compromise anonymity. The great thing about employing this on the sender key mechanism is that previously we had encryption individually to all the receivers of that single-sized or constant-sized sender key packet. This increases the communication overhead, but now here we just have a keychain that is symmetric, and all of the receivers basically again have a receiver keychain for that anonymizing thing, and they don't store the chain. Instead, they pre-compute keys and tags, and then once they receive them and find the tag in their database, they use the key, remove the key and tag pair, and then de-anonymize with that key. So again, or the great thing here is that the size of the ciphertext is not increased, at least asymptotically. This was the final thing, topic-wise, that I wanted to talk about. This is a protocol that we currently work on with Signal to implement that thing. So still, right now, Signal is using their sealed sender thing. We developed that for another protocol that we use for mesh communication, so Wi-Fi, direct Bluetooth communication. But Signal is interested because, especially, it makes things much better for their sealed sender group communication setup. That was it for the lecture, for the course, for the hard parts. Next week we have a questions and answers session. So best is you prepare some questions, then I can give you some answers. If you don't have many questions, I can't answer many things. We will probably do a quick run through the lectures that we've had, through the topics that we've had, through the interesting aspects of these topics. But yeah, that is more or less it from my side for that semester. Thank you very much for your attention, for your interesting interaction, for your discussions, questions, and so on. It was a pleasure. And yeah, see you latest next week, or then for the oral exam for whoever registered for it. Thank you.